Good evening. I'm Heather Brown, and it's time for Between the Covers. In his novel, Shadow of Ashland, Toronto author Terence Green has woven an intricate story encompassing history, fantasy, and mystery. And at the center is the very crucial element of time travel. Narrator Leo Nolan is pursuing his mother's deathbed wish to find her brother Jack, who disappeared 50 years earlier during the Great Depression. Leo arrives at Jack's last known address, the Scott Hotel in Ashland, Kentucky. There he finds his elusive uncle, but Jack's still a young man. Leo has been whisked back to 1934, where he gets involved with helping Jack and a group of men dig a tunnel under the hotel to a bank they want to rob. Then disaster strikes. The tunnel collapses with Jack in it. No amount of frantic digging can save him. Here's Michael Hogan with Episode 9 of Shadow of Ashland.
The water crept up over the curbs onto the sidewalks. By dawn, the town was beginning sandbagging operations. The bank did not open for general business that day, but it did open special at 10 a.m. for the armored car that pulled up in front of it. I watched from the veranda as the rain poured down steadily and the gray figures moved from bank to truck and back again, gathering the money, escorting it to the train and out of Ashland before it, too, sank beneath the water. That evening, I stood knee-deep in water on Winchester Avenue, hands in my pockets, the rain running off my chin, down my neck, into my eyes, feeling where the pavement had buckled slightly beneath my feet, facing the Second National Bank. Jack, I thought. Jack. And then it was over. Everything changed. The air changed. The water was gone. The rain had stopped. The wind blew warm and sultry. I looked about me at the present, at the hot August night of 1984. I was back. The lightning dashed in sheets in the sky, and I stood as I had that night outside the First National Bank and Trust Building, looking into the smiling face and warmth that was Jack Rady. "It's hot here," I heard him say, "but I like it. I like the possibilities." He stared at me, silhouetted in the radiance from a streetlight, a young man confronted with his future. "A man can make something of himself down here. Anything can happen." He moved closer so that I could see the glow of hope on his face. "Do you know where I could go from here?" I didn't know. I didn't know anything. "God." He ran his hand through black curly hair. There was a flicker of lightning like a strobe. Then he turned and stared at the mountains at the east. "It's like the jumping-off point to anywhere." He paused. "I'm on the edge of the Virginias, the Carolinas. I could go right through to Richmond or Norfolk or up to Washington, Baltimore, Atlantic City. It's all ahead of me." He turned to face me again. "You tell Margaret I'm fine. Tell her everything's fine. Tell her I miss her." He offered his hand. I took it. His eyes sparkled. I nodded. "I will." He smiled openly, warmly. "Nice meeting you, Leo." I smiled in return. "Margaret wants you to stay in touch." "I will," he said. And then he was gone. It happened like that. The moment of purity and insight and belief and hope and regret and possibility folded up and vanished into the stillness. I looked down at the cracks in the sidewalk, the shallow depression at my feet. I went back to room 8 at the Scott Hotel. For most of the night, I sat in the blue upholstered easy chair, staring out the window into the darkness, seeing nothing, seeing everything. I think I fell asleep. I'm not sure. I'm not sure of much anymore. In the morning, I went to the basement of the Scott Hotel and stood on a cement floor. Where the drain pit had been, there was a proper metal grill fixed in the floor. Everything was dry, reasonably modern. I stared at poured concrete walls. The entrance to the tunnel was gone. "Who are you?" I turned to see Stanley Matusik, balding and time-worn, standing at the foot of the stairs behind me. "I'm just who I said I was." "I know you. From somewhere." I nodded. "Maybe you do. He looked at me. The eyes searched. You know, don't you?
I think so.
How?
I just know.
He knew it was true. Been over 50 years. Then he asked, what do you know?
I know it didn't work. I know they're in there. Jack, Jimmy, George.
I glanced at the wall where the tunnel had been.
Yes and no, he said.
My senses sharpened. Maybe I didn't know.
You know about the rain, about the flood.
Statements, not questions.
Yes.
Whole goddamn thing came down. Water turned everything to mud. Filled both tunnels solid like they was never there. When it finally receded, when everything dried up, you couldn't even tell there'd been anything but solid ground there ever.
He walked over to the concrete wall, stared at the opening in his mind.
We dug the whole thing out again, me, Henry, Emmett, and some others. Took us 8 weeks to do it properly. By then, rumors was going around. Folks in town seemed to know what had happened. Jimmy and George's families must have talked. We asked them not to. He shrugged. What can you do?
Don't really blame them.
He turned and looked at me. We found Jimmy and George. Found their bodies. He studied my face. Never did find Jack. I realized that I had stopped breathing.
He wasn't there.
What do you mean he wasn't there?
Gone. Don't know what happened to him.
That's impossible.
Yes, he said.
I know. He walked with me up the stairs and out into the morning air. We sat on the veranda. A steady drizzle had started. Steam rose off the sidewalk. Could tell it was going to rain last couple nights. He folded his hands in his lap, looked at me, looked at the sky.
Maybe you just missed him. Maybe he got washed away.
I tried what I had been thinking aloud, tried to make sure.
He shook his head.
I don't understand.
Not sure I do either. Man goes into the earth, doesn't come out.
Again, he shook his head.
We made certain before we sealed it all up. Took Jimmy and George to their families. They buried them in family plots and their properties out of town. Like I said, rumors were flying. Nobody asked too many questions, though. There was enough talk that we forgot the whole idea of the bank and the money. Wouldn't have worked no more.
He stared hard at my face.
There's something missing when I look at you, Leo.
Something I can't remember.
Like you're a piece of a puzzle, but I can't fit it in.
Whatever had happened to me, I realized hadn't happened to him the same way. He studied, probed, frowned.
Can't get a hold of it. Like a wisp in my head, and it's gone. Like I should know something more about you.
He was quiet for several seconds. Then,
it couldn't have been, no, could it?
No, I said. It couldn't.
Mind plays tricks on you, especially when you get old.
Plays tricks on everyone, I said.
Dug a new basement out in 47, he said, after the war. Put jacks under the old building. Poured a new concrete foundation.
He pondered.
Our scheme, everything we did before that, seems like madness when I think about it now.
Was the times, I said. There was a kind of madness everywhere. I thought of Henry, whose little girl's hair fell out.
What happened to Henry?
To Emmett?
Died, said Stanley. Both of them died back in the 60s, long time ago. Henry had cancer. Emmett just seemed to die.
Hard, I think.
So it's over.
I'm alive. Ain't over in my head.
Long's I'm alive, he said, it ain't over.
His eyes weakened. I remembered the looks he had given Jack and Teresa, his knowledge of something between them, and I realized that I could never know what his motives had been for sending Jack into the tunnel that last time, or whether he knew himself. I realized that it was time to go. In my room, I packed my things. My eyes lighted on the microwave, the bar fridge, and I thought of Emma's efforts to accommodate me, to encourage me to stay. Emma. And it hit me for the first time. I stepped into the parlor and gazed in wonder at the child's portrait in the elongated oval frame. Yes, I thought.
It's me.
I turned to see Emma Matusik standing behind me. It was taken in 1941. I was 6 years old. I thought of how she had wanted me to stay, of how Jack had wanted me to stay. You could see him in her eyes. You could see the sudden, startling blue. You could see the cheekbones, the dark, curly hair. Jack. My mother. The Rady features.
Did you find Jack Rady? She asked.
Hotels, rivers, tunnels spanning two countries flooded into my head. I saw men digging, women working, and Jack and Teresa together stealing what they could from life. Yes, I said, and I felt my heart swell in my chest as I looked at her. My cousin.
I needed to find him too, she said.
I nodded, understanding. My mother told me enough of the story when she was ready to tell it, when I was ready to hear it. I was in my 20s. I found an old book from the local library at the back of a shelf in my mother's closet. I was looking for one of her sweaters for her. I picked it up and wondered why it hadn't been returned. There was a photograph of a young man between its pages. It was Jack. He used to take pictures, you know. I knew. Mother didn't keep any other mementos. It didn't seem right. She and my father built a good life together. They managed to live with it. Does Stanley know? Mother says he doesn't, but I think he does. He's never said anything, though. He's a good man. She paused. I love him very much. Does your mother still have the photo, the book? She gave him to me. I have him. I waited. Would you like to see him?
Yes, I said.
Carefully, I opened a 50-year-old copy of Mom's Moon and Sixpence, held the yellowed black-and-white photograph in my fingers, and lingered over the incredible, piercing eyes and the dazzling white smile for the last time. Jean approached me along the curved counter with her pencil poised over a yellow receipt pad. Her smile had started the second she caught sight of me coming through the doors.
You still hungry, fella? Can't get enough of Kentucky cooking?
The strand of hair fell out from behind her ear. You just whetted my appetite.
Glad to hear it.
Interested in a little excitement?
Fast lane, life on the edge. It's where I live. Look around you.
She jerked her head to indicate the nearly empty store.
How far is Cincinnati?
About 90 miles.
If you can get out of here a little early, you, me, and Adam could be sitting down in some good seats at Riverfront Stadium by game time. The Cardinals are in town for a set. Should be a good game.
You know much about baseball?
Hardly a damn thing.
Want to go? She was undoing her apron. I'd like to see him try to stop me. It was a hot, humid night. Perfect for baseball. We ate hot dogs and ice cream. Bought the overpriced programs. On the way out of the stadium, I paid $5 for a pennant for Adam and watched his face light up. Jean put her arm through mine and pulled me to her tightly. It was past midnight when we got back. Jean got Adam to bed, then went with me downstairs to sit on the steps of the veranda. When I looked at Jean, she was watching me.
Something's happened.
Yes, I said. Something has happened.
You found your uncle.
I tilted my head to one side, trying to decide what would make sense.
Yes and no.
She waited. Found out he isn't here anymore. Found out he's probably dead. She leaned her head against my shoulder. I found his daughter.
She living here?
Yes.
Married?
No.
Her mother?
Never married my uncle. Married someone else. Still married to him. I paused. It's complicated. Her hand covered mine. We sat in silence for a while. Then Jean looked up at the night sky.
Rain's passed.
I looked up, too.
You're leaving, aren't you?
A statement. I looked down, nodded. She squeezed my hand. We had a good time.
I got a job back home, family.
I know.
Have to go back.
I know.
I didn't know what else to say.
Will you stay with me tonight? She asked.
I'd like that, I said. I'd like that very much.
I left Ashland the next morning, crossed the Ohio, went along 52 to 23 and north. I saw a small family cemetery high up in a hill, and thought of how much more natural it was to bury one's dead like that than the way it is for most of us now. I thought of George and Jimmy. I had lunch at the Court Cafe in Bucyrus. Later, because it was hot and because I was tired, I pulled off Route 4, the Lincoln Highway, had a Pepsi at a gas station, and read a poster for the Seneca Caverns, the ones which I had read about on my way to Ashland. I got back in the car and followed the signs. 15 minutes later, I pulled into a modest picnic area, parked, and walked into the rickety gift shop. The sign above the shop announced, "Enter the caves in here." I told myself I needed the break. I bought a ticket for the next tour. There were about 20 of us. A local high school girl led us down the poured cement stairs. I felt the temperature drop into the 50s, felt the sweat cool on my skin. I left the upper world behind. The cavern had been formed by an earthquake millions of years ago, a giant crack in the earth. The roofs and floors, it is pointed out, would fit perfectly into one another if compressed. The high school girl delivered her well-rehearsed speech at each point of interest. When we reached the bottom, we were introduced to Old Mystery River, which, we were told, had defied all attempts to measure its depth or locate its source. I asked her if it ever rose up higher into the caverns. "During fresh at thaw," she said, 10 years ago it rose right up to within 10 feet of the entranceway. But," she added, "it always drops back to its proper level." Turning, we retraced our steps up out of the cavern. I wanted to go home.
Episode 9 of Shadow of Ashland by Terence Green. The reader was Michael Hogan. Tomorrow, Leo's father receives more letters from Jack. We'll sign off with a poem about being on the road and at the end of a relationship. Shane Rhodes is a Calgary poet. His poem, Driving, is read by Guillermo Verdecchia.
Driving. 2,000 miles, and you and I are driving through the prairies. Driving to the East Coast through these small words and endless repetitions of space. The pavement splayed through fields as if, too, feeling its limits. Stations on the radio surface in and out of static, the music of this place. Wheat baking in summer thermals. Barley at the side of the road bends in our wake. In this bruised light, you sleep, and we could be nothing but the chronicles of our escapes. Always surprised by what we loved, by what chose to love us. If we spoke, what would we say? Something full of longing but empty of appetite? An insight from the radio gospel hour or bargain finder where someone gets closer to God while someone else sells a tractor? There is something I want, and the more I enter it, the more I need to enter. At a laboratory in CERN, the radio news now, they have discovered a new type of matter. Something smaller than smallest. While we, on a road in northern Nebraska, have found the oldest type of space. There is no end to what we run away from or to. Even together we were more singular than alone. Praise be to God, the scientists croon as they chain-link the world. Poplars by the side of the road fall into their name. We will disappear then, too, like matter, into the history of our complaints.
Guillermo Verdecchia reading Shane Rhodes' poem, Driving. It's from his collection, Holding Pattern, published by New West Press. And that's our program for this evening. But before we go, I'd like to remind you that the Between the Covers collection of audiobooks is available through Goose Lane Editions. Selected readings from past seasons of the program are available on CD or on cassette. For more information and to order, you can call this number toll-free, 1-888-9-COVERS. That's 1-888-926-8377. Stay tuned now for the CBC Radio 1 News, and then it's classical music from CBC Winnipeg on Northern Lights.